We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We'll talk this morning about money management, something that we do as a regular feature each month on the program. This is always on a Friday, and we built these shows into the schedule to give people a regular opportunity to ask very specific questions about their own financial planning situations. And we have two guests here in studio with us this morning. Both of them have been on the program before. Our regular financial guy, David Sinnoh, is here. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business and has been joining us on a regular basis for a very long time to do these shows. And also with us this morning is John Masetich. He is the owner of Kensington Financial. That's an investment advisory firm. It's in San Diego. Since 2002, he has spent time here on the campus, generally in the winter, teaching wealth management courses, mostly to seniors. And the idea is to try to teach students how to set up and maintain a comprehensive financial plan. So he's been on the program a number of times before when he's been in town, and we're glad to have him here, glad to have them both, so you can take advantage of their expertise to answer your questions. And again, the idea is for people who have particular questions about their own financial planning situation, call in and give us some information. They might want to ask you a question or two, and then they will do their best to tell you what they think. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. And also email, you want to send in your question that way, will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Well, thanks both for being here. Glad to see you, John. Have you back on the program?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
And good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I think we're going to start with John because John's got some introductory comments about mutual funds. Then I'm going to take about a minute and just update the couch potato portfolio. And then hopefully we'll have a number of questions from our listening audience.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for inviting me, David. Pleasure to be back.
Sure.
Now, I'd like to first get into, the topic that's on everybody's mind right now, the terrible situation in Japan. And we can all commiserate with the terrible problems they have there. But I think this also affords all of us to reconsider our stock portfolio, especially our mutual fund portfolio, in light of what's happened in Japan. So last night, I looked at a sector fund called the iShares Japan Fund. And here's what I calculate. From March 3rd, when this whole problem started in Japan, through yesterday, the iShares Japan Fund is down about 12.3%. In just 2 weeks, we've had a 12% decline. Now, that compares to the American stock market, based on the Vanguard Standard & Poor's 500 fund. That's down 4%. So I guess this is no surprise to any of us. The Japanese stocks are down three times more than the American stock market. And interestingly, the Vanguard Emerging Fund, and David, you still have this in your couch potato portfolio.
I do.
Okay. That's also down about 4%. So there isn't much difference between Vanguard Emerging, which is non-Japanese, you know, much smaller, the so-called developing markets rather than the developed market of Japan, Canada, the United States, and so forth. The Emerging Market Fund and the American stock market are both down about 4%. And this iShares Japan Fund, a fund that's rather typical of Japanese portfolios, down about 12%. So it's down by a factor of three compared to the American stock market. Now, this is a sector fund. And the definition of a sector fund is that kind of a fund that invests in the companies in a particular industry or sector of the economy. And as such, this kind of fund is not diversified. It's inherently non-diversified. So I also hasten to add that I own a sector fund. You know, full disclosure here, I own a China fund, the Matthews China Fund. That was hardly affected by this whole problem in Japan. But the bottom line is that sector funds are dangerous, very dangerous. They're extremely volatile. You're inherently undiversified. And so my strong advice would be to everyone should take a look to see if they have some sector funds in their portfolio. I think there could be a small place in your portfolio for a sector fund. I personally own the Vanguard Healthcare stock. I'm betting on the aging baby boomer spending a lot of money, you know, when we enter Medicare. And I own the China Fund, as I just said. But these amount to a very small percentage of my portfolio. So I think everyone should take a look at that. And this kind of leads into the subject of whether Vanguard Emerging, in fact, is not a sector fund. So I took a look at Vanguard Emerging today. I went to Morningstar.com, a very fine website, by the way, if you want to evaluate your mutual fund. And here's what I found in the Vanguard Emerging Fund. They're invested in these countries, and here are the percentages in each of these countries. In China, they have 18% of the portfolio, India, 8%, Brazil, 17%, Korea, 13%, Taiwan, 11%, Russia, 7%, Mexico, 5%, South Africa, 7%, and so forth. And when I look at all of these countries, I see a very wide swath of the global stock markets, a very wide swath. And I ask myself, you know, what do China and Mexico really have in common? What do South Africa and Brazil have in common? And the answer is, I think, very little, except very high growth, very high GDP growth, which has gotten translated into very high capital gains over the last few years. So my conclusion is that the Vanguard Emerging Fund is not a sector fund because, you know, it's a very wide swath of the global economy. And so I think there is a place for this. And I'm personally invested in this. I have all my clients in this. And I think my personal percentage is about 2% of my net worth in the Vanguard Emerging Fund. And David, what are you running in the Vanguard?
I'm at 2.5% in the Emerging Market Index in the Couch Potato portfolio, plus Total International Index, of course, also has a position. So that pushes me above 5%, and that's more than a mouthful.
Yeah, I think 5% is more than enough. So I think there is a good place, whether it's the Vanguard Emerging or the Fidelity Emerging Market Fund, I don't think it really makes that much difference. But so I do not think this is a sector fund at all. And the final thing I'd like to cover on mutual funds is that I ran across a very good article recently in Morningstar. And Morningstar, by the way, is this very fine Chicago company. They're on Wacker Drive. And they are arguably the finest mutual fund evaluation company there is. And they do really good research. And they're famous for their star system of evaluating mutual funds. And they have this proprietary system where they look at the rate of return over 1, 3, and 5 years. And then they look at the return per unit of risk taken. They basically divide one by the other. And then they grade all funds on that basis. And if you get a 5-star rating in mutual fund, that's the highest. 3 stars is average, and 1 star is the lowest. And, of course, Morningstar touts their system as being something valuable, something that you can actually use to predict future performance. The problem is that the academic studies that have been done on the predictive value of these Morningstar ratings, that's kind of a mixed bag. It's not a surprise that Morningstar thinks they are predictive, and they have their own internal studies showing that. But in the academic world, which I think might be a bit more objective about it, they say it's kind of a mixed bag whether you can use the star system to predict future performance. But one thing that Morningstar does say, and there's actually no doubt about this, they say that expenses really do matter in the long run. And so I think everyone ought to look at the so-called expense ratio of their mutual fund. You could go to Morningstar.com and get this, or you can also get this at YahooFinance.com. And the expense ratio is simply how much you're paying to the fund on a percentage basis. So are you paying 1% per year? I think actually the fund, the industry average is about 1.3%. David and I have both argued over the years that you ought to be in the lowest expense ratio type funds. Vanguard is probably the lowest in the industry at about 0.1, 0.2%. But the Morningstar study concluded that the expense factor is actually a better predictor than the star rating of Morningstar. And then there's another piece of evidence that corroborates what Morningstar found, and I want to quote John Bogle. Now, John Bogle, I would consider basically the dean emeritus of the mutual fund industry. He's the co-founder of the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds. He also started the first index fund, the Vanguard 500 Fund, in 1977. And his research also shows that if you compare a high-cost fund, and that would be a fund with an expense ratio of maybe 1.5 to 2%, and you compare that high-cost fund to a low-cost fund, like a Vanguard fund at 0.1 or 0.2%, over a long period of time, you will probably earn 50% more. Think about that, 50% more. Just this one single factor, having a low-cost fund versus a high-cost fund. And it was a very good op-ed piece that he wrote, and you can actually probably find this on the internet. This was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal published August 27th last year. And, David, I know that you're a great fisherman, and John Bogle offers this very good fishing metaphor here. Now, fishing is something I really don't understand or appreciate, but we'll leave that to another day.
Okay.
But here's what John Bogle says about expenses and performance. Quote, do your fishing in the low-cost pond.
I think, John, that is excellent advice, and that's why I've actually set up the couch potato portfolio in the manner that I have, is because the overall expense ratio of that portfolio is quite low. It's at least 1% lower than being on the active managed mutual fund side.
So yeah, and what John really Bogle says, actually, if you can save about one, he says his specific study says that if you can save about 1.2% per year on expenses, you will make 50% more in the long run.
Right, and I teach that in my classes. I have no interest in making Wall Street brokers rich. They have enough brownstones already in Manhattan, and I have no interest in subsidizing their lifestyle. So as a consequence, you and I are both on the same page. You're preaching to the choir, and that is that low-expense, no-load mutual funds make a heck of a lot of sense. John, I'm just going to jump in here and point out that we have updated our couch potato portfolio, and through last night's close, our portfolio essentially is up only 1.23% per year for the year, and that compares last month, we were actually up about 6.8% last month. So you're right, the portfolio has dropped. Stocks have dropped 4 to 5% overall in the last really 2 to 3 weeks. So through last night's close, our portfolio is up 1.23%. Interestingly enough, the S&P 500 is up about 1.68%. So at the moment, global diversification has not outperformed the simple S&P 500 index, which you would think of because international stocks have done a bit more poorly than U.S. stocks in general. But there's still some time. We're only in March. Spring is around the corner.
I will point out, though I think that your couch potato portfolio is actually doing a little bit better than a balanced fund.
It is.
I think if
it
you
is.
Look at the Vanguard Balanced Index Fund, which is 40% bonds, and bonds are up for the year. Mm-hmm. Bonds have been on a real tear for several years right now. So the fact that you're beating a much less risky fund is pretty good.
Yeah, thank you. And, of course, as we always point out, the couch potato portfolio is simply for some equity exposure. It's not your fixed income exposure. It's not your insurance. It's not your annuities. It's not your CDs. It's not your cash on hand. Certainly not your emergency money. This is really long-term investable funds. David, I know that we had a question about annuities that came in.
I also have an email here that has come in, and why don't we do that? Maybe also let me, for people who might have just tuned in, let me introduce the guests, David Sino, John Masetic. They've both been here on the program before for our monthly personal finance show. Dave is a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business, and he's here once a month, and on occasion also John, when he is on the campus teaching, he is here as well. He's an adjunct lecturer of finance in the College of Business. He has a business, it's called Kensington Financial. It's in San Diego, California. It's an investment advisory firm. And generally in the winter, he is here and does teach wealth management courses. And when he's here in Champaign-Urbana, he's also been here on the program. So we're open to questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, here is the question, and I've actually kind of had this in mind myself as being something you might want to talk about. The listener writes that he is 59 and he has purchased over $50,000 in prepaid tuition from College, Illinois. An article in the paper last week said it was underfunded and not guaranteed by the state. My kids are 7 and 10. Should I take the money that I can get back out of this and do something else? The idea was to buy these 16 semesters of college for my kids at yesterday's prices to protect us from inflation. Now they say inflation is so high, the program is 30% underfunded. He writes, even for Illinois, this is pathetic. And he also writes, by the way, Washington keeps telling me there is no inflation. Somebody is lying to me. So what do you say about that?
I've been asked that question probably 50 times in the last 2 weeks since that article came out. My first comment is 30% underfunded isn't so bad when we compare that to the pension system in the state of Illinois. All right? So let's put things in perspective. And many, many programs, even though they are 30% underfunded, can last a heck of a long time. Now, it is technically correct that the state of Illinois does not guarantee College Illinois. That's what we're really talking about, is the prepaid tuition program. It's referred to as College Illinois. And very, very frankly, it was a great deal. It's a wonderful deal for the people who put the money into College Illinois, because the state of Illinois, in their infinite wisdom, actuarially obviously underestimated the increase in tuitions, which have really been almost at a double-digit pace for a number of years because of the state of Illinois and the lack of funding to the various state institutions. But that's an old story, and we all know about that. Even though it is not specifically guaranteed by the state of Illinois, it reminds me of, for example, the programs that the federal government has with the housing crisis, and that is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those were not technically guaranteed by the federal government. Has any holder who has held one of those notes had any problem collecting their interest or dividends? No. And I think the bottom line is that the state of Illinois is going to have to stand behind College Illinois. My goodness, there would be such an uproar, and the Illinois legislators would be hounded. It would make the Wisconsin State House look like kindergarten. That would be my belief. So don't pull your money out. Continue to feel reasonably comfortable. And I think that those payments will be made by the state of Illinois. Now, the program is going to change. In fact, it already has changed. But for people who already have funds in there, I don't see those funds particularly at risk. And that's what I'm advising.
All right. Well, very good. We have a caller here then also to talk with, somebody who is in Niles up in the Chicago area. Line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hi. Dr. Sano and guests, I do have a question for you. And it has to do with my thoughts about choosing a dividend growth company fund as opposed to a annuity with purpose, or at least with the eye towards dividends as an alternative to a alternative. Would you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I do. I haven't looked into the specific fund, but I've read very good reports about a specific Vanguard fund. I think it's called Vanguard Dividend Growth, in fact. Mm-hmm. Dividend is certainly in the name, so just go to Vanguard.com and pull up a list of Vanguard funds. I think their emphasis is on not only companies that pay high dividends, which would be defined today as something in excess of 2%. If you look at the S&P 500, the average dividend yield is around 2%. So I think they're concentrating on funds that are paying, you know, probably in the range of 2.5% to 4%. And second, and even more important, they're looking at companies that have a long history of increasing the dividends. For example, I recently bought a stock, and I'm not necessarily advocating the stock for anybody, but I bought Johnson & Johnson, you know, goes back, I don't know, 70 or 80 years, and they have a very high dividend yield.
Yes.
And they have a history of increasing the dividend. And it's a very solid company financially. And I think if you look at the Vanguard Dividend Growth Fund, that's the kind of companies they're buying, solid blue-chip companies with a high dividend yield and good prospects for increasing the dividend.
And so, large cash positions and low leverage, mm-hmm. low debt. So they are in a position to pay substantial dividends.
And also I think that Vanguard Dividend Growth Fund, I know it would have a very low expense ratio too. Probably the lowest in the industry for that type of fund.
And do you see that as an alternative to, let's say, someone who would also look at an annuity, again, for purposes of a fixed income?
No, I think it's apples and oranges. I mean, here you're talking about a stock fund, and then there's obviously risk with a stock fund. Mm-hmm. With an annuity, you know, it's very low risk. You have an insurance company typically standing behind the annuity. And you're guaranteed never to, you know, as long as you live, you're going to get that annuity payment. There is no guarantee from a stock mutual fund or even a bond mutual fund of that sort.
But, of course, one of the difficulties with an annuity, and I do harp on this, is typically they have very high expense ratios. That's one problem with them. Number two, there are often surrender charges if you want to get out of them. But that is a certain kind of annuity, and we can talk about three or four different kinds of annuities. And three, they're not inflation-adjusted. That, I see, is one of the major drawbacks to a simple annuity, that over a long, long period of time, that periodic stream of payments remains the same. And because it's not inflation-adjusted, well, the purchasing power of that money becomes less and less each day, each month, each year, each decade, unless you choose to purchase something called an inflation-adjusted annuity. And very frankly, the verdict is still rather out on inflation-adjusted annuities. Some are halfway decent, some are better than others, and we can talk about that as well. But John's absolutely right. It's completely a different kind of animal. You're trying to compare apples and oranges. But that particular type of fund, where you look at companies that are well-known, they've historically been around for a substantial period of time, very strong cash positions, low leverage, a pretty decent play when interest rates are basically delta zero. Because in the short run, regardless of whether you're in savings, short-term CDs, et cetera, we all know what we're earning, basically nothing. And because the banks aren't willing to pay anything, they're much happier to take free money from the government and essentially go out and buy treasuries and earn 2 or 3% and continue to rebuild their balance sheets on the backs of the American taxpayer and on the middle class. That's really what's happening.
Yeah, my thinking was that if I turn money over to an annuity such as you suggested, it's the money is lost. Yes, I'm going to get some sort of a interest, a dividend, and it's lost. Now, you know, there's nothing left for inheritance. My thought was with dividend growth companies, I put it in. If they go down or whatever, I get my payment, and I'll still have that money or some portion of it left for inheritance. Does that make any sense, or am I way off target here?
No, not really. As a matter of fact, in retirement, a number of folks have dividend-paying mutual funds, and as opposed to reinvesting the shares in additional mutual funds, they essentially take those shares and have them redeemed in cash. And that cash then is sent to you, it's put in your account, and then you utilize it in your retirement. It's one piece of the pie. It's not the entire pie, but it certainly is a reasonable strategy. What do you think, John?
Yeah, agree? I agree. And I will add this, that you can do both. Hedge yourself, you know.
Okay.
You have a stock fund, you know, as you're describing. A different sort of animal, and in contrast to that, you have an annuity, you know, which is essentially a fixed income type of asset. Consider doing both. And, you know, one is a stock-oriented thing, and the other one is a bond-oriented thing, in essence. But on the annuity, my strong advice would be maybe wait for a year or two, because I think David and I both feel that interest rates are bound to go up sooner rather than later.
And what really happens is these annuity rates that you earn are set by the American Gift Annuity Association. And right now, that has been in a downward trend. So if interest rates started to move back up, you might see some increase in interest rates so that ultimately the annuitized payment that you would earn would be higher. Something that is popular are called immediate annuities, and that is to take a lump sum of money at retirement. You part with it, you're absolutely right, handing it over to an insurance company, and then they immediately begin paying you an annuitized payment based upon 10 years, 20 years, life certain. There's all kinds of choices. But before you make that choice, you have to sit down with a financial planner who can tell you exactly what the imputed interest rate is on that particular annuity in that stream of payments.
Yeah, and that imputed interest rate right now is going to be very low. You know, we're talking somewhere in the 3 to 4% range. So I think maybe you ought to wait on the annuity. And in fact, I think that that rate that's published by the American Gift Annuity Association, I think they come out in the summertime. I think it's only, they make an announcement about once a year, and I believe it's June, July. So we'll have a new rate published pretty soon.
Right. But you can go to their website. You can Google, essentially, American Gift Annuity Association. Click on it, look at it, and you can see the rates that they're recommending based upon life expectancy, based upon your age, and the joint life of your survivor or spouse. So it's very interesting to look at those rates.
All right. You folks, as always, have given a great deal of information, and I thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. We've got some other callers lined up here. We'll come back to someone local, and that is someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I sort of resonated with your opening comments because I have some money in the Vanguard Pacific Stock Index Fund now. It falls under your categories of sector, even though it does include Japan, Australia, Hong Kong, et cetera. So I wonder if you have any comments about it. More than what you've already said.
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose this can be considered a sector fund, but I still think that it's probably closer to Vanguard Emerging than it is a pure sector fund.
Uh-huh.
Because when you think about the Pacific region, it's not just Japan, China. It's also Australia, New Zealand, uh-huh. Indonesia, Malaysia, Taiwan, South Korea. And what they all have in common, except for Japan, are rapidly growing economies. So I would probably, despite the recent downturn, I assume it's down. I haven't looked at it recently.
It is down. It's down. Well, it says it's down for the year by 6%. I don't know what that means because I didn't see the I can't do the comparison of the, what should I say, the 10 days as you just did.
That's not too bad, 6% since the first of the year, because Vanguard Emerging, I think, is down about 5%.
Vanguard is down 5.21%.
Yeah. So you're hanging right in there with Vanguard Emerging.
Absolutely.
I would hang in there with that fund.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it so long as it's a small percentage of an overall diversified fund.
Yeah. And it does seem that right now, I mean, since also currency changes affect these, right now it seems like there's all sorts of currency issues with the Japanese yen, et cetera. And I wonder if you might talk about that as well.
So. I would agree with you. I think what you're implying is that these currencies in the Pacific area are going to rise against the dollar. You know, that may not happen in the short run, but I think in the long run, it's certainly going to happen. The Chinese currency will certainly go up. The Chinese are controlling its upward ascent to about 3-5% per year. If they just let it float freely, their currency, it would probably zoom up by 20-25%. So that's going to rise. I don't know about the yen. You know, that's
well. The yen has been a very volatile play the last few days. Of course,
right.
In fact, it was down to 75 yen to a dollar, and then the G6 announced that they were going to take and move into the yen, and suddenly now it's about today. I think it was about 81 yen to the dollar. A lot of dollars American dollars have been sold. They've been repatriated into Japanese yen, which of course made more demand for the yen. Insurance companies in particular were saying, oh my goodness, we're going to have to sell a lot of investments, a lot of assets, because we're going to have to pay for a lot of deaths and a lot of insurance claims. So that put upward pressure on the yen. Historically, people repatriate under crisis situations. But now we seem to be back in a situation where we're in that 80-81 range. So it's hard to say. But unquestionably, I'm absolutely agreeing with John on the China situation, that if you are in China-denominated currency securities, that's going to play in your favor eventually when we have this reevaluation of Chinese currency.
I'd also add this, that if you look at those Asian Pacific countries, they had a banking crisis in the 90s and their currencies imploded and their stock markets imploded. And now, flash forward, if you look at their banking system, it's actually in much better shape than our banking system. They didn't have a financial crisis this last time around. So these countries like Korea and Taiwan and so forth, their banking and their financial system is in pretty good shape. So I think the long-term outlook for their currencies is very positive.
One other point about the Japanese stock market, the Nikkei index, which really represents the big companies in Japan, it's hovered for a substantial period of time below 10,000. Now it's hovering around 9,000. 20 years ago plus, it was at 40,000. So you can imagine that it has dropped 75% from its historical highs. And that just tells you about the malaise that Japan has been facing trying to grow its economy, and just tremendous structural problems to grow that Japanese economy over the last 20 years.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll go on here. Next is Normal. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a pretty simple question. My husband and I need a new car. They cost about $25,000. And our mortgage, what we have left on it is $27,000. And it's at 5.35% that we're paying on the mortgage. I suggested that we pay off the mortgage and then get a loan that would be less for the car. What do you think about that?
Well, let's understand a couple of more facts. Have you looked into the financing on the car?
Yes. We got at the dealership, it was 0.9%.
So it's 0.9 of a percent.
No. Yeah.
And that is the annual percentage rate that you would be paying, 0.9 on an annualized basis.
Uh-huh.
And over what period of time would you be required to pay that back?
60 months.
That is very, very difficult to turn down. That's almost free. That is free. Now, admittedly, your interest annually at 1% would be $250. That is not tax deductible, but that is such cheap money that if you are interested in this car, you feel comfortable with the deal that you have been able to negotiate, and you have 0.9% financing, which tells me you have superlative credit. You have excellent credit if you are being able to procure 0.9%. That's very, very tough to turn that down. Very, very tough to turn that down.
So it would be because we could just buy out the car, but I don't think so.
I think over the next 60 months, you can do better than 0.9% on your money.
Yeah, I'll also add this, that if you pay off your first mortgage at 5.35%, it's like making 5.35%
of
your money. If you're going to reduce a cost, it's the same as making a positive rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard, and that's a guaranteed 5.35% return, I might add. You can't get a guaranteed 5.3% anywhere today. Unless you buy muni bonds issued by the state of Illinois, well, I don't know, David. What do you think about that?
No, I don't think so. So I think here's the bottom line. We're agreeing. Pay yourself first. Pay yourself the 5.35. Earn 5.35 by paying off the mortgage.
Uh-huh.
And then take advantage of borrowing at 0.9%.
Yes.
Your cash flow will improve dramatically. You'll be in a brand new car. Something else. I want to talk about car insurance for just a moment. Make certain when you buy that new car that you have insurance that essentially replaces that vehicle for a minimum of 24 to 36 months. Because the minute you drive that car off the lot, it's going to depreciate in value.
Uh-huh.
All right? Maybe 10, 15, 20, even 25%, depending upon the vehicle. And if, unfortunately, you were in a car accident and the car was totaled, most insurance policies say they will pay you the actual cash value, which is really the depreciated value of that vehicle. You still owe on the contract for 60 months at 0.9%. You owe that $25,000, and the insurance company says, here's a check for $18,000. You would be a very unhappy camper.
Yeah.
So as a result, spend a little bit more money on the car insurance policy, get a special endorsement that provides replacement costs typically for the first 2 to 3 years that you own that vehicle. And that way you ameliorate the impact of depreciation on the car in the event that, unfortunately, you gave the car to a family member, maybe a grandchild or a daughter or a son, and they totaled that car on you. I know you're careful, but maybe someone else who's driving the car isn't as careful as you are. So I'm spending a little bit of your money to get that endorsement on the insurance.
So pay off the mortgage.
Yes.
The low interest rate on the car.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right.
That's what I thought. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, we are at the point here. We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guests are David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. He's with us monthly on the program to do this Money Management Show, and it's always on a Friday. Also joining us here as a special guest, John Masetich. He is an adjunct lecturer of finance in the College of Business. He's the owner of Kensington Financial. That's an investment advisory firm in San Diego, California. And for a number of years now, he's taught wealth management courses here on campus each winter and has been with us before on the program. So we're open to whatever questions you might have. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And, of course, if you'd like to send us an email, you may do that as well. 333-333. Yeah, that's the phone number. Will-talk. See, I can't quite get used to this newfangled email thing. Will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have, I think, some other folks here ready to go. Yes. And I think this would be somebody in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to talk about a Irrevocable Living Trust.
Yes.
And my main concern in this trust is the impact on estate taxes. Does it, when we deed our property, and it's farmland in this case,
yes,
to the trust,
yes,
will we be avoiding estate taxes as it passes?
Well, you might. You might. And typically what is recommended is to place assets into revocable living trusts.
Okay.
Now, currently, are you married?
Yes.
All right. So then each of you, you and your spouse, should each have a separate revocable living trust.
Yes.
And what you do, and probably your lawyer has told you this, is to equalize your estates, and that is to pour in to each of these revocable living trusts an amount of assets up to a minimum of $5 million if you happen to be in that position. So let's just say that farmland has appreciated dramatically, and suddenly we have a farm that used to be worth $2 or $3 million. Let's just pretend it's worth $8 or $10 million. And what you would do is you would pour, by re-deeding into your revocable living trust, 50% of that farmland in revocable living trust, your revocable living trust, and then 50% into your wife's revocable living trust.
Okay.
And if you set it up correctly, at least under current federal estate tax law, for the next 2 years, you could essentially convey to children at your second death $10 million of assets sitting in those two revocable living trusts. That's for federal estate tax purposes. So if you just simply held it in joint tenancy with the right of survivorship, or your will said, gee, at our first death, I give everything to you, or you give everything to me, then all of it ends up in one estate, and there's only one $5 million exclusion. By having two separate revocable living trusts, we set up $10 million of federal estate tax exclusion. Remember, a trust is a private document. It is not probated, so nobody gets to read it down at the courthouse. A will, on the other hand, is a public document. Pay for the photocopying. Anybody can read it down at the courthouse. So what the will should say is, I leave all my personal property to my spouse, and everything else, I think it's already in my trust, but if it isn't, it needs to pour over into my trust. Trusts typically are beyond the claws of creditors. That's another advantage of a trust, because creditors can only generally get at things that are in the probate estate. A trust does not generally pass through probate if you've already retitled the assets in the trust. Lots and lots of good reasons to have a trust.
Oh, so it is effective to avoid federal estate taxes?
Federal estate taxes, and it also will avoid some Illinois inheritance taxes, but Illinois has decoupled from the federal estate tax rates. And typically in Illinois, each of you would have a federal an Illinois exemption of approximately $2 million, and then after that, you start paying Illinois inheritance taxes. However, there are some special mechanisms and means to avoid some of that. So you need to have an excellent estate tax planner who can provide you with that information and show you different opportunities to further avoid certain unnecessary inheritance taxes.
Oh, great, great. Okay, super. Thanks a lot, David.
Yes. Right, very good. And on again to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Okay, I'm not sure if this is the right format for this question, but it regards our mortgage. My wife and I have worked very hard to plan for entering into retirement, and our mortgage is going to be paid off soon as we get ready for that transition. And in fact, we in May we'll be writing our last mortgage check to
the bank. Congrats.
But my question is, what kind of documentation or paperwork should we be asking for with the bank as we prepare for this transition?
Well, basically what's going to happen is that when you pay off your final payment, the mortgage company is required to provide you with what is called a legal release. And typically you have to pay for the recordation of that release, and that is a factor of which courthouse that you're going to file that release in, and that, of course, is in the county where the property is located. Typically, that cost is somewhere between $25 and $50. So in most cases, your lender, when you make your last payoff, then the lender will request that additional dollar amount to not only draft the lease, but they will then send the lease to the courthouse for recordation, and then it will be mailed to you. In addition, you can request, if it can be found, the original note and the original mortgage documents, and they should be marked canceled or indebtedness paid in full. The release is the real operating document, but in addition, you can request the note and the mortgage. Now, interestingly enough, because these notes and these mortgages have been sold, repackaged, resold so many times, it might take a while to figure out who's got that original paperwork. It's probably sitting in some file cabinet in some massive warehouse, who knows where. But in any event, you should make the claim for the return of those documents.
Okay.
All right? Contact your lender when you're going to make your last payment. Say, is there a cost for the release? This is going to be the last payment. And if so, how much? How do we tender it? Et cetera. And then at the same time, make that claim for the original paperwork.
Okay. And that legal release and the recordation is the most important document.
Absolutely. John, you want to add something?
Yeah, I want to add two things. First of all, I want to congratulate you on you've obviously done a very good job in planning for your retirement. I read an article the other day in the Journal that said that only 25% of Americans nearing retirement were actually ready for retirement and able to maintain their current standard of living, only 25%. And second, caller, I think you ought to have a mortgage burning party.
We plan on that.
Good.
Are we invited?
Well, if I can figure out how to get you there, yeah.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think, John, I saw that same article or something like it. Mm-hmm. Was it something to the effect that the average person said they had only saved, $2,000, $6,000?
That's right.
It was a very small amount of money.
Not only that, but there was a large percentage of people who had no idea how much they had in savings, you know, toward retirement. They didn't even know. And then there was a related article recently, and it talked about the average net worth in the country, the average family net worth. And it was a pretty nice number. It was $505,000. And that was down last few years, as you would guess, from about $550,000. But then I thought to myself, is this average or is this median? And it turned out to be the average. Mm-hmm. So I did a little research on the internet. In fact, it only took about 30 seconds to find this out. I looked for the median net worth, and that number is $92,000. The median is 92. The average is 505.
Wow. So the median, that's the one that's just the exact middle.
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we're coming down to the point. We have about 5 minutes left. You know, earlier we had someone who wanted to have some conversation about annuities. And I know you've actually have said a couple of things about annuities. And I don't know if in the time that remains there's anything else in particular. It was just a general kind of request to talk about annuities. And I don't know what you might want to say.
Well, remember that an annuity in financial terms is simply a periodic stream of payments. And there are all types of different annuities. One of the most common is referred to as an SPDA, a single premium deferred annuity. That's where you take a hunk of cash, you hand it to the insurance company, and then each year the insurance company says, as long as you leave it with us, we will pay you an interest rate on that money. and maybe it's 2%, 3%, 4%. But the advantage of us as the insurance company is that interest and those earnings grow tax deferred. And until you take them out, when you retire, they just continue to grow. That's called a single premium deferred annuity. And then came along, well, you can take your hunk of cash, you can do a single premium deferred annuity, but instead of our offering you a fixed interest rate, a fixed guaranteed rate, here are a menu of stocks, or here are a menu of mutual funds and bonds which you can buy. That's called a variable annuity. And we're going to put the rate of risk, the growth rate, back on your shoulders. If you're a good investor, why, your annuity value will go up. If you're not such a great investor, your annuity value will go down. That's often referred to as a variable annuity. I'm not a big fan of variable annuities. They have very, very high expense ratios. And as we talked about early in the game, that's a major problem. Expenses make a huge difference. Also, if you are fortunate enough to make money in a variable annuity, when you take the money out, the income is taxed at ordinary income tax rates. That's in contradistinction to a mutual fund, where if your mutual fund goes up significantly in value and you sell it, you typically will have capital gains treatment, which presumably will be at a lower interest rate than a variable annuity. So I'm not very excited about variable annuities. They're sold literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of variable annuities are sold each year by insurance companies, and it's a huge profit center for the insurance companies. What I really want to talk about, and John, you can talk about this, are charitable or what are called gift annuities.
Yeah, that's a very good thing that you might consider purchasing. And in fact, my wife and I just bought one through the University of Illinois Foundation. It's called a charitable gift annuity. And the payout rate, it depends on your age, but I'll use myself as an example. We put this in my wife's name, who just turned 70, and we're getting a 5.9% payout. And interestingly, let's say you put $100,000 into such an annuity. This is an immediate annuity where we start getting immediate quarterly or monthly payments. In the year that we purchase this annuity, let's say it's $100,000, you get about a 35% tax write-off immediately on that $100,000. So you put in $100,000, and now on Schedule A, I think it is, of your Form 1040, you can write off $35,000 or $40,000.
And that number depends upon, of course, your joint ages of husband and wife or your joint annuitant.
That's right. And here's an idea. You can buy an annuity where Will Radio or the University of Illinois will be the beneficiary.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. So you get an immediate tax deduction because the theory is that while they are paying you back at this 5.9% rate, a part of that is the return of principal. And of course, they have it figured out. So at second death, between the owner of the annuity and the joint beneficiary of the annuity, they're not going to outsurvive all of that money. And a substantial amount of money is then going to be left at the end, which then goes to WILL, the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. or whomever. Mm-hmm. It's really a lovely program. It's a wonderful way of gifting and at the same time really earning rather substantial market rates.
Yeah, and I would add this, that let's suppose you're going to make a gift to charity anyway upon your death. Why not do it now? Why not accelerate the gift and get some benefit out of it in terms of an immediate annuity payment?
Real quick, we have a couple minutes here, maybe about a minute and a half. One thing I want to come back to with the conversation that you had earlier about mutual funds. And essentially here you were talking about the expense ratio and the fact that the low-cost funds have higher yields. You do better in a low-cost fund. And just to make sure I understand this, the expense ratio, essentially what we're talking about here is what it costs to run the fund.
Including the management fee of the fund.
That gets deducted first. Then the amount of money that fund makes, then it gets passed out to
well, that's
the investors.
Right, because what happens, David, is a fund has something called a share value. It's really referred to as an NAV, a net asset value, each day. Yeah. And that net asset value really is based upon the overall value of all of the securities minus 1/365 of the daily expenses, mm-hmm. which include the escrow expenses, the management expenses, all of these different expenses, and they can run up to 1/4, 1/5 in these particular kinds of funds.
Or even higher.
Or even higher.
So is, though, really the thing that we're talking about here is the big difference between funds that are actively managed and funds that are index funds? So yeah, it's the money that's being paid to the guy, to the people who are running the fund?
Right. And they and they are under enormous pressure to outperform the benchmarks, which is very, very difficult to do over long periods of time.
Yeah.
Over short periods of time, yes. Yes, you can outperform benchmarks because there's so many people trying to outperform benchmarks. Simple blind luck would suggest that some people are going to outperform benchmarks. But it gets much tougher over longer and longer periods of time.
Yeah, in fact, the Vanguard 500 Index Fund that John Bogle co-founded in 1977, that has outperformed something like 70 to 80% of all actively managed funds. It's an incredible record.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're just about at the point we have to finish up. I don't know if there's any last little thing you might want to mention to folks.
Well, let's see. We could talk. I had some information about Social Security, but we really don't have a lot of time to talk about that. Interestingly enough, Social Security is now running a negative cash flow for the first time because we have so many people who are unemployed who never thought they would be unemployed at 62, 63, 64, that they are retiring early. And as a result, we've got more people retiring, grabbing their Social Security. We, of course, have still about a 9% unemployment rate, and that's still very debilitatory. So for the first time, we now have a negative cash flow in Social Security. That's a tough place to be.
All right. And my apologies here. We have a question that came in here that I've just now seen that here, and it's a question about tax-deferred annuities and required distributions. And maybe what I'll say is I hope that the caller can join us next month because we'll see if we can answer this question.
70 and a half.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, that's where we'll have to leave it. Our guest's David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. He's here every month with us, always on a Friday to do these shows. And as our special guest this morning, John Mcedic, he is an adjunct lecturer of finance, and he is the owner of Kensington Financial in San Diego. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.